St. Vrain. Do you know what the status is?
I believe that is out in Idaho. I think that's the case. It was taken away from Fort St. Vrain quite some time ago.
And
yeah, people nodding their heads, yes.
Yeah, okay. All right, yes. All right, so, and just the deposition of that fuel? In other words, what was done with it?
I believe it's still sitting wherever it's sitting right now. But I believe it is at Idaho.
Just did the disposal of that, I think, had...
It ultimately, like everything else, will have to go to Yucca Mountain. Is that what you're asking?
No, I was just wondering, you know, how they sort of pulled it apart.
Oh, whether they pushed the sticks out of the blocks or...
Yeah, exactly.
I do not know the answer to that. I do know that you can do it either way. I mean, if you can paint a scenario for the ultimate disposition of this fuel, leave it in the blocks and just bury the blocks, if you will. I mean, this fuel is capable of being reprocessed too, if that's an option. But you can either bury this, you know, take the sticks out, use the blocks again one more time probably, or bury it in the blocks if you're going straight from, you know, the reactor to underground repository.
Yeah, and that was another, that prompts the sort of a second question is, normally we move the fuel around to several places in the reactor at the moment, just to make sure we get we use a lot, we burn up the fuel adequately, and I was wondering how you do that in an HTGR.
These would be refueled about every 18 months, and you've asked a question. I don't believe there's fuel shuffling. I think you take all of the blocks out and replace them on a refueling. I believe that is the case. But that's a good question. I need to go back and refresh on that.
If you'd like, I'll
get you the answer.
I'd appreciate that very much.
All right.
The only plant on here that you have that I've had a chance to spend any time at was Fort St. Vrain, and it was a commercial nuclear plant. And it had a great theory on how it operated, and a very strong CEO who really believed in an engineer and it would work. The only problem with it was with the water moisture intrusions and things.
Yes,
it was a very safe plant because it didn't run. And so
no, it had a terrible.
I understand the theory, and the theory is great.
Mm-hmm.
But can you get the equipment that will make that plant run? And that would, is that a problem? And do you have access to the Chinese, what they're doing? That's the only people seem like to be doing anything right now, because I assume the Japanese probably haven't got anything running over there right now. So
yeah, you were absolutely right about Fort St. Vrain. Peach Bottom ran like a top, was a great reactor, high availability. Fort St. Vrain was designed by maybe a physicist instead of an engineer, who decided to eke out a few more percent of efficiency out of it by cooling the bearings in the helium circulator with water. And so what kept happening is water would kept being sucked into the core, which is not a safety issue, but it is an operational issue. So the thing was down, and it was lots of water, not just a little bit. The thing was down a lot. It had a less than 20% availability, and ultimately it was shut down in the early 80s. It was non-economic. It wasn't worth it. And that's when the bottom was falling out of the nuclear market. But interestingly, a couple of things. Nobody would ever think about having water-cooled bearings in a helium circulator now, so we're so beyond that. But the other thing was that at that same time period, even with the lousy operating record of Fort St. Vrain per se, there were 10 units on order. General Atomics had 10 units on order, primarily from Delmarva on the East Coast, for more HTGRs. The virtues of these reactors were quite realized, and it was also realized at the time that there was a bad engineering mistake made on that particular design. Like a lot of reactors, those were, you know, in the 80s, those reactors, the orders were canceled, and General Atomics bought their way out of it, and you know, that was part of a whole wave of the decay of the nuclear industry, if you will.
What kind of helium leakage rates are we talking about? Because, you know, helium is sort of a small molecule.
Yeah. The leakage occurs basically within the confines of the plant. So there are helium makeup tanks. It's not substantial, if that's what you're asking. I mean, I can't off the top of my head give you that. If you're, again, if you're interested in that, I need to write these things down. If you're interested, give me your card. I'll get you the info.
Yeah, sure. I mean, TriSoft Fuel, I mean, I was looking at those things at Oak Ridge and I hate to say in the early 70s. And I was wondering, you know, it's interesting to hear you. Yes, that is the basis still for HTGRs today.
It's really good fuel. That's why. It's just a great design. If, you know, if you think about it, what would you clad nuclear fuel in? You know, something that's extremely hard, something that's resistant to fission product leakage, and something that can withstand high temperatures. Well, what is that? It's ceramic material. So that's exactly what this is. And spherical is good in terms of being a pressure vessel. So you sort of naturally go that way.
I mean, could other inert gases be used instead of helium? Because helium's getting sort of rare for medical purposes and things like that.
Helium has a lot of very extraordinary qualities. The British reactors were CO2 cooled. The problem with CO2, at high temperatures, it's corrosive. Helium, I'm sorry? And it's not, it's, anyway, helium's really the best thing for this. I've heard people mention nitrogen, but in terms of scarcity of helium, right now, I've been involved in these discussions a little bit. Right now, the shortage of helium is primarily market issues and infrastructure issues. It's not like there's a worldwide shortage, really, of helium. There's plenty of it. How much do you want to pay? But if you had a deployment of these of about 700 or 800 modules over time, it would be about 1% of the world helium market. I mean, the equations are rather, you know, get into a little calculus there, but that's, it's not a major, it's not a deal killer for these. Okay.
Thank you.
Just one more. Have you had any discussions with Sasol?
Maybe early on, certainly the South Africans who invested in the, in the 2000, well, I don't know, I'll just be approximate in dates, but from, say, 2000 to 2008, 2009, the South Africans had a very aggressive pebble bed development program, and certainly there were, and Westinghouse was part of that, and certainly there were lots of discussions with Sasol. We just have not gone down there and had major discussions. There are some other cold liquid international technology folks that we are talking with, yes.
But that's predominantly coal gasification. And
now it's gasification. It was cold to liquids for a while. As I understand it, they've sort of morphed a little bit.
Well, it's been coal gasification for a while. But I was particularly interested when you mentioned Louisiana because of their announced facility from natural gas. And I was wondering what was going on there.
Yeah, that has. I'm taking a minute. I thought you were talking about the Cheniere export terminal. You're talking about the gas liquids facility there.
Yes, right. From natural gas going to using that as a basis instead of coal, and Sasol's investment, this spring. Basically,
I'm sorry. I don't know any. I mean, I know about it, but we've had nothing to do with that. I'm not familiar with it.
Thank you.
I just want to make sure I understand. The driver here is the high temperatures. This is not a power generator. This power is ancillary to getting the.
You mean the electric power, or?
Yeah, the driver for these reactors would be industrial uses of high temperature.
It could be, but these would be quite competitive on a cost basis if you just built them for electric power use. But imagine in a case where you're Dow Chemical and you have to have, you can't turn on and off your source of industrial heat. Your processes have to go all of the time. And so they don't ramp up and ramp down well. If you were going to start using these reactors, and let's just say this is very hypothetical, I'm just making this up, you needed four reactor modules worth of heat out of this. You would because sometimes you're going to be refueling, sometimes the reactor might decide it doesn't want to work for one reason or the other, you have to build extra. So let's say you build six of these reactors, two of which are not at any one given time producing heat. You don't want those to just sit there, so in theory you're going to be producing electric power and putting that on the grid until you need them for the heat. So you need both of these virtues, if you will, of these reactor modules.
Okay, I just thought that the heat was driving it more than... You have to give me a tutorial here, because you said NRC was reviewing white papers. My first part of the question, part A, to what purpose? And then this, at what point does NRC think they need to start reviewing, regulating? And then when you talked about Waterford being a regulated site and the issue about putting the HETR at that site versus putting it at SRS, where does NRC fit in the picture, and can you do these things without any kind of regulatory oversight? Reactor?
That's a lot of questions.
Yeah, it is a lot of questions. You can see how I know nothing.
let me start backwards. Our goal, and I think it's consistent with the only thing that's possible about these, is to get NRC licensing for these reactors. That's the only way, as far as we're concerned, to think about it. There have been people within DOE that have argued, no, don't do this, build a small test reactor somewhere. We don't think that's the way to go. All that does is add cost and decades on to the time when you get to the ultimate product we want, which is a licensed reactor design that we can go off and not, and we're not going to build these things, by the way. We're just trying to midwife these reactors. So NRC, that's very relevant. I may skip one of your questions here, but let me go back to your first question, which was about the white papers and so on. To date, the primary money for and action for this has been paid for by DOE through the and done through the Idaho National Lab with assistance from some of our members, Entergy in particular, most relevant, but also Areva and Westinghouse have been quite involved in it. And it's in the development of these white papers that are sort of preliminary licensing sort of stuff. And as I understand it, some of those white papers and safety cases have been used for the SMR, by the SMR licensees. So there's some relevant space there or overlap. But then the next part of your question, sort of what next, I think you were asking, is when does NRC get serious about this? And they get serious about this when we can bring to the table, because Uncle Sam is not going to do it, but when we can bring to the table substantial development money, have a site, and are ready to move forward. That's when you start to build it, and then they come, sort of. And as far as Waterford, regulated, unregulated, I'm not qualified to go. That's kind of internal politics at Entergy, and I just raised that just because that is kind of a quirky thing about that site. I don't think Entergy is ready to step forward on that site or anything. So I don't think it's a SRS versus Waterford.
So have you started like the design and control document, DCD, and all that kind of the stuff you need for an application?
No. It's all very preliminary.
And you may not know that, I'm just curious about this, but I know that Exelon was heavily involved in the pebble bed.
Yes.
And pulled out for some reason. Do you know what that was about? In the South, they had people in South Africa.
Yes, I think Exelon had a CEO at the time that was extremely interested in these, and actually that CEO, Corbin McNeil, this is a little, and maybe I'm going beyond what I should say. So Corbin McNeil came out of Philadelphia Electric, which ran Peach Bottom, and a lot of people at Philadelphia Electric loved that Peach Bottom reactor, and so I think that's where he got the bug, if you will.
Yeah.
But I'll say no more. But ultimately, for whatever reasons, Exelon walked away from that.
Yeah, okay. That makes sense to me.
So does the alliance have employees, or is all done on a loan employer contract basis?
Contract. So there, a lot of the companies, Dow, Entergy, Westinghouse, Areva, do this work in kind. I'm an employee by contract, and there are a couple of others also.
Okay. Wyoming's interest, I take it, is on the amount of coal that they produce.
I'm sorry. Say
Wyoming's that. Interest is yes, because yes. they produce so much coal.
That's a problem.
Is there a specific entity within state government at Wyoming that has signed on to this?
Or governor's office.
The governor's office.
The governor himself, Governor Mead, has sat through these meetings. He's personally interested.
You said that you're looking at $316 million to complete the R&D effort.
Yeah.
On one of the slides, that does not include, I assume, the amount that's been spent to date, right?
Correct. To date, the numbers are funny because when you, those of you who work with DOE research and development or any research and development budgets, you know that Congress will appropriate, in this case, it's been over $600 million for this project. The amount of money that's actually gotten to the project is probably somewhat over $300 million. And most of that has been spent on the things that I showed you there. Very little of it has gone to industry. There was maybe about $50 million in a couple of tranches that went to industry in an earlier phase for some early design work and a little bit of licensing.
Your scheduling slide showed a deployment in 2026, which I understand may be optimistic. But
yes.
Doesn't that also show licensing going out to 2028?
I think that would be subsequent modules. So this, the deployment module, or you see that, I'm sorry, down, this right, down here, you've got second, third, fourth modules running out there. So NRC license would be relevant there. The assumption is each subsequent module takes around 3 years or so.
So when the first one comes on in 2026-ish, would it be licensed?
If you're asking Part 50 versus 52, is that
licensed by any entity? Could be
yes,
could be NRC, could be DOE if you did a research.
No. We're DOE really does not have any more licensing structure.
Okay.
For this sort of thing, for commercial entity, which is what we're concerned about primarily, is wherever it's built, if it were built at SRS or wherever, our argument would be it needs to be licensed by the NRC so that you're ready to follow on with these units elsewhere on a commercial basis.
Okay. You said no metal in the core. Could the Russians have made that same statement about their RBMK design?
That was a very, very the only thing I know, or the main thing I know about RBMK, number one, positive void coefficient. Number two, the graphite really didn't burn. It just blew up in chunks out of there, okay. That's a very different reactor design, irrelevant here, really.
But you still have some metals issues to overcome, right? With the high temperatures that you're talking about, things like the reactor vessel, the piping.
The limit, if you will, we put on that 750 degree outlet temperature is, if you will, a tip of the hat to the fact we want to use already qualified, you know, ASME steels and so on.
Okay. Who do you envision will be the designer of the reactor, or will there be multiple designs?
Yeah. I didn't say, let me back way up here. Where are we? This particular design, coming into this, there were three designs on the table. There was a 200 megawatt pebble bed that Westinghouse's design. That was basically close to the South African design. There was a 350 megawatt thermal General Atomics design, which was also a prismatic block, somewhat smaller, obviously, and then a 625 megawatt thermal design, which was Areva's, but it's also General Atomics and the Russians, the three, and Japan was involved early on. But anyway, Areva took it much further than the other entities. We as an alliance, went through a down select process and chose this one, and the choice was no more. In a sense, it wasn't pebble versus block or anything, but this had the economy of scale. It was the largest. The energy costs are, price out of it was about 25% lower than the other. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, so it'll be the Areva design.
Yes.
Okay.
But so far...
You have a bit of an unholy alliance there between Areva and Westinghouse. So
that's what I was just going to say. So far, they're playing nice.
Okay.
And we hope that that will continue. And actually, if this really becomes something, I suspect there'll be some other players involved, too.
Just a couple of things. If I tried coal gasification sort of in the world, which I normally think of as Sasol as being real development leadership. But then coal gasification in the United States, I normally think about Eastman and their implementation in 1980. And I was wondering, how come Eastman is not involved? Because,
funny you
know,
you should mention that.
Yes.
In the first couple of years of the alliance, Eastman was a member of ours. Eastman, they, in their Tennessee location, they are, I think this may be what you're alluding to. Perhaps.
Yes, in 1980 but, they started
right,
there.
They depend on coal for a good deal of heat and power. And they've got a problem if there's a limits on carbon or whatever. So they were a member, but then the and potash was a member of ours too, by the way. But when the price of natural gas went, they both left us, unfortunately. But anyway, long answer to a short question. They were a member.
Okay, so then that prompts a question in terms of the the quality of the alliance and carbon credits and how heavily is it dependent on the alliance on holding together in terms of carbon credits?
I'm not wishing for that, but if it happened, it would be helpful to us. But like any proponent of nuclear of any kind at this point, or solar collectors or windmills or whatever, the price of natural gas has sort of sucked the air out of the room, if you will. It makes all of these alternatives very difficult. So I don't want to tell you any differently than that. It has not made our job easy.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Mark, very much.
Okay.
Obviously, there was a lot of interest here.
Yeah, thank you very much for your question.
Thank you. Shelley Wilson will give us an update from DHEC. Thank you, ma'am.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the Council. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much. So many of us in this room have been enjoying the great successes of Savannah River site recently. Last year, the closure of two tanks, 18 and 19. They've shipped a large amount of transuranic waste to the disposal site in New Mexico and have cleaned up a large percentage of contaminated areas at the site. So these successes are the result of a lot of hard work on the part of DOE and their contractors, as well as on the part of regulators and stakeholders. But I'd like to focus for a moment on high-level waste, since the storage of 37 million gallons of highly radioactive and toxic liquid waste in aging tanks, 8 of them partially or wholly in the groundwater table, since that waste in those tanks represent the single largest environmental threat in the state of South Carolina. So in 2005, we were largely at a standstill. And then with the help of our federal delegation, a law was passed that helped us get past the legal hurdles for tank closure. So at that time, we sat down with DOE to come up with a plan for moving forward. And we did that in concert with the Governor's Nuclear Advisory Council and agreed on common goals and values, such as minimizing the residuals that were left in South Carolina and timely closure of the high-level waste tanks. So from that point, we started building momentum as DOE established interim treatment for the salt waste, and we worked out a pretty complicated regulatory and technical roadmap for the ultimate treatment of the waste and tank closure, and we made sure that our plan matched our common goals and values. So we watched all of that hard work pay off as the tanks 18 and 19 were closed. The first tanks closed in 15 years, and we thought that we were ready to close the other tanks in a similar fashion on an agreed-upon enforceable schedule stretching from now until 2022. So today we're in a very unique position. We're not arguing over regulatory or technical issues, as we see some other sites in the DOE complex where they're arguing to the point where the progress is at a snail's pace. Right now, we, DOE, the contractor, EPA, and many of the stakeholders, we're aligned and cooperative in our approach to tank closure. And I just want to point out that is rare. It's very rare when you look at the nation. It's a testament to our working relationship, and we're very proud of that. So the problem is that the proposed budget can derail all of that. The current FY13 budget is very, very tight. It barely keeps us afloat in terms of regulatory commitments, doesn't move us forward in terms of long-term goals. And when you couple that with the president's budget request for FY14, you're in a position of basically giving up hope that DOE can meet its regulatory milestones for liquid waste, a host of them, including 30 milestones for waste removal and tank closure in the federal facility agreement, also the startup milestone for the big salt waste processing facility, and also the waste treatment completion milestone that is in a consent order with the state. So the cumulative impact of the FY13, the FY14 proposed budget, that cumulative impact robs us of our future by making it almost impossible for DOE to reduce risk as promised in those regulatory milestones. So furthermore, missing those milestones would subject DOE to penalties ranging from $3,000 per day to $105,000 per day, depending on the milestone. So you can imagine at the point when, if we're talking about assessing penalties on the part of DHEC, we're a lot less cooperative than we have been in the past with DOE. So the key thing I'd like for you to remember is all that we need for success is a sufficient budget. So I have focused on liquid waste, but I also want to touch on transuranic waste for a moment. The disposal of that, the legacy transuranic waste that had built up at the site. So much of that has been shipped to the waste isolation pilot plant in New Mexico, but there is some remaining. And when I started working with Savannah River over 20 years ago, quite a while, I thought that all of that legacy TRU wouldn't be disposed of until the 2020s. So a good ways out into the future. So to DOE's credit, they have been very aggressive in disposing of transuranic waste. Now at South Carolina DHEC, we helped with that. We negotiated an amped up shipping infrastructure for that TRU waste, and we also used our regulatory flexibility to allow for multiple shipment preparation areas so that shipment could go faster. So again, most of that legacy TRU has been disposed, but not all of it. And the FY13 budget again extends the schedule for finality until FY14. So we're urging DOE to finish the job and close the door on that risk and apply request dollars, apply dollars to getting all of that legacy transuranic waste shipped for disposal. So again, all that we need for success is a sufficient budget. And with sufficient funding, we stay on track and the risk is reduced on a timely and agreed upon schedule. So with funding like we see in FY13 and FY14, we see deferral of the work needed to make progress. We see strain and possible loss of key people at the site, the possible turn of a largely cooperative relationship with DOE and regulators into a combative one, and the potential failure of DOE to live up to its commitments. Now I'll add that we're also we also have an added concern to that because we believe there's a disparity in the way some of the sites are in the proposed budgets that we see for some of the sites across the complex. If you look at the FY14 budget, for example, the Hanford liquid waste budget is increased by 20%, whereas at Savannah River site, the EM budget takes the biggest hit of anybody in the complex. And all of that hit, around $100 million, is coming from the liquid waste budget at Savannah River site. So, again, that strikes us as quite...